Let's start with our motivation. I'm sure you do this, but I wonder how often we pause and think, how in the world did I get here? How in the world is it that I have this human body? How'd that happen? How in the world did it happen that it works well? The mind works reasonably well. I live in a place where there's plenty, where there's education, pretty much a place of peace compared to other parts of the world. How did that happen? How did it happen that I met the Buddhist teachings? Most of us certainly didn't grow up in environments or weren't born into environments where that would be predictable. How did that come about? How did it turn out that I am attracted to these teachings and have the energy to show up for class or turn on the internet and look for this kind of thing when there's many, 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 many other things I could look? How did that happen? And so we know the textbook answer. You know, we've generated some merit somewhere. This is a ripening result of past actions, but to really reflect how much merit we must have created. Who knows when? Who knows how many different lifetimes worth of merit have come together and ripened in our opportunity right now? But whenever we're feeling discouraged or lost or alone or confused, we can look at this fact and go, wow, somewhere, sometime, some being associated with this continuity of consciousness created a tremendous amount of merit, and I am reaping the fruit. And then what am I going to do with it? Because as good as our circumstances are right now from that point of view, they are also fleeting in every single moment. And our time left is very, very short. However old we are, not much time. So as we spend time looking at inconceivable merit of Buddhas tonight, we can rejoice in the merit that brought us to this moment. We can think about all living beings around us who, just like us, want to be happy and don't want to suffer and haven't had the good fortune in this life to even learn how to think about creating causes for happiness. And seeing that we're just like them, remembering that we rely on them completely, 100% for everything that we enjoy. And seeing that they, just like us, are caught in a cycle of existence, but mostly don't have an opportunity to get out. Let's dedicate our practice tonight and our practice of our lives in order to create the merit, create the causes. That will allow our compassion to grow. That will plant the seeds for our wisdom to grow. That we set our hearts on the motivation of bodhicitta to become Buddhas in order to benefit and liberate every single living being. So let's set that as our motivation. Oh, Venerable Children is in Russia tonight. And we are here. And I will share with you that there is a tick that is sharing this body with me, and I'm chasing it around surreptitiously, but if I happen to find it, I'll let you know. So we are continuing with our Precious Garland quiz, quiz 8. Questions 5 through 7. We're not going to get through many of those tonight, because there's a lot of material here. And it's been really fun. It was packed in, but it's been very fun to cover it. So these three questions, well, this first one anyway, starts us on to chapter 3, the collections for awakening. And in Geshe Tekchak's book, which is, you know, what Venerable was teaching from during this time, the chapter title is Joyfully Taking Up the Boundless Work of a Bodhisattva. And she gave the bulk of the teaching on these three verses March 3rd, 2016. So they're not so fresh in our memories, probably, depending on how much time people had to prepare. Maybe not at all. But they're really joyful teachings, so I'm happy to do them tonight. So I think we covered last week. We did. Nagarjuna reviewing that the main causes necessary to attain the peerless state of awakening are, yeah, bodhicitta, wisdom free from the two extremes, and compassion. And the text, Kinsir Tekchak's text, goes back to the Chandrakirti's praises, how he praises these qualities in his salutation from the supplement. The hearers and solitary realizers arise from the excellent sages, Buddhas, the excellent sages are born from the bodhisattvas. The compassionate mind and the non-dual awareness, as well as the awakening mind, these are the causes of bodhisattvas. So this is the topic that Nagarjuna is taking us to now in these verses. Let me see. It's like we're starting with verse 200, 201. So Venerable was saying that Buddha, bodhicitta, compassion, and non-dual wisdom are the causes, right? So as we practice these three, the result is what? Buddhahood. The collections of merit and wisdom that lead us to Buddhahood. Yeah. Those are the three causes of a bodhisattva. So as a bodhisattva, we put effort into collecting the two collections. And these collections are only possessed by bodhisattvas. So the first question we have, question 5, why is the merit necessary to attain Buddhahood immeasurable? Who has an answer?
Very measurable because they are based on compassion for all sentient beings. Mm-hmm. And the wish to benefit each and every one of them. And the number of sentient beings is immeasurable. Therefore, that's called immeasurable compassion.
That's good. What else?
We can't really grasp the full function of each sign, mark, quality of the Buddha, or the merit necessary to attain it. So it's too big for us to kind of wrap our brain around.
Yeah. Any other thoughts? I mean, I think there are a number of things, actually. There's not one single answer here. I mean, the short answer I came up with is the qualities of the Buddha are immeasurable. Therefore, right? But that is the short answer. And it's true that this term inconceivable means beyond our ability to conceptually grasp it. So boundless, countless, limitless, incalculable, immeasurable, all of those words mean that it's so much we can't grok it. But it's not infinite. And that's a very important point that she stressed when she gave the teaching. It's limitless. It's so vast that you can't count it. But if it were infinite, we would never get the result. It's just too big for us to think about. And she says the same thing is true with sentient beings, that the countless sentient beings is huge, but there is a finite number. It's not like we're constantly creating new sentient beings all the time. So we can't imagine how many there are. At the same time, there is a limited number.
So I stumbled upon verses 219 and 220. And so here it says, I think it's very related, remaining for an immeasurable time and wishing to obtain immeasurable awakening for the sake of immeasurable beings, the bodhisattvas perform immeasurable virtue. So how could they not obtain before long awakening, even though it is immeasurable through the collection of these four that are immeasurable?
Exactly. Exactly. So this whole section, he's talking about immeasurability for about 20 verses, I think. And even though Nagarjuna says these things are immeasurable, then he lays out the math. And this was not a part of the questions, but I don't know. I find this very, I don't know about inspiring. I guess inspiring. Really fascinating to think about what merit is, what our possibilities are, what our potential is, where it could go. So that's a lot of what I want to focus on tonight. So starting verse 202, a single pore of the Buddha is made from 10 times the following amount of merit: the total merit from which all solitary realizers have risen, the total merit that produced all learners and those beyond learning, and the total merit of the entire universe, which, like the universe, is measureless. Each pore of a Buddha likewise arises from that much merit. And then he goes on for how long? Up through the Dharma conch. So I really did do the math. So think, just think, what is the merit producing each and every solitary realizer? Each and every solitary realizer throughout, I don't remember how many eons, but there are eons. There are 100 eons? Yeah, okay. Meditating, reflecting, propelled by their spontaneous or uncontrived renunciation for liberation. Okay, then the merit produced by every single hearer that is both on the path and every single hearer arhat who has achieved the result. Doesn't take as much, but it's more than I have. And then every single one that has achieved that. Then take the merit that produces each and every human rebirth. I think since beginningless time, every time there's been a human rebirth, that's come from a ton of merit, right? And each and every God realm rebirth. Then, if there wasn't any more merit, any other total merit of the entire universe, times 10. That's already inconceivable. And that is one pore of the Buddha's body. Now, I looked up. A human body has approximately 3 trillion pores, depending on the size, height, and so forth. Now, so if I just went with 3 trillion for the Buddha, so we have the merit of one pore times 3 trillion. So all of that stuff times 3 trillion times 100 equals one of the marks, of the 80 marks of a Buddha. So 3 trillion, 1,000, million, billion, trillion. I've got too many zeros there. One set too many. But that's all right, because we're going to multiply this by 100 too. Of the 80 marks, then, times 100 of those equals one of the signs of a Buddha. So, you know, the things like the beautiful light web fingers and the shaped ankles, one of those is all of this, all of this, all of this, all of this. Then we get 32 signs. Oops, I left out my times 32. 32 signs. times 1,000 is the curl in the Buddha's forehead. And my calculator stopped doing zeros, so I couldn't do it anymore. All of this, including the curl, times 100,000, the Ushnisha on the Buddha's head. Crown protrusion that's, you know, an indication of merit. Then, times 10 zillion, all of this times 10 zillion brings about the Dharma conch or the Buddha's speech. I mean, even trying to make it conceivable, it's inconceivable. Completely inconceivable. So, you know, Venerable said so much merit is needed to attain the Buddhist teach because it's actually the most important aspect. You know, because it's through, we can't contact Buddha's mind, but through Buddha's speech, teaching the Dharma to trainees and leading us on the path, that's how its effect. So the bottom line here is immeasurable. So when we think about Buddha and the path to Buddhahood, it's not about, and she cautions us throughout the teaching, it's not so much about trying to feel overwhelmed or even try to match it, but to get this expansive sense of how much positive potential is involved in ripening into Buddhahood. And then it also helps underscore when we talk about, and we'll talk about this a lot more, but when we're doing actions in relationship to the Buddha and the Dharma, which is equal, and the Sangha, because the Buddha is an Arya being, right? Sangha, three jewels. When we are doing actions in relationship to that powerful merit field, how much merit we also create. It helps, in my mind, it's like, wow. It both helps me appreciate what we have as far as an opportunity here and how much applying my mind to be intentional would make so much more. And sometimes I do. It's not to discredit my practice completely, but I could do a lot more. So I found all those zeros really inspiring. Because then the next question is, what enables us to create such immeasurable merit and why? Us. See those zeros? What enables us to create such immeasurable merit and why?
This came from the Bodhisattva Bhumi, page 618. The marks and signs of a Buddha are attained by practicing for three countless great eons. That is an immeasurability of time.
Mm-hmm.
Since the virtuous activities that produce the marks and signs are governed by an attitude that seeks to bring benefit and happiness to an immeasurable number of sentient beings, there is an immeasurability of attitude. Since the marks and signs are produced by an immeasurable variety of virtuous deeds, there is an immeasurability of types of deeds. So we've got the bodhicitta attitude, we've got the virtuous activity that we engage in, so that's all kind of part of where we're right now, starting to get that kind of mind that can do these things.
Oh, beautiful. Good. Anybody else find anything?
Well, Venerable Nyima already read the couple verses there, but there's verses leading up to that that talk about, verse 2:14 says, you should not be discouraged about accumulating the merit for attaining awakening, since there are reasons to be reassured, set forth by both reasoning and scripture. It says, in all directions, space, earth, water, fire, and wind are immeasurable. So too, it is acknowledged the dukkha of sentient beings is immeasurable. Through a bodhisattva's love and compassion, these countless sentient beings are led out of their dukkha and definitely brought to Buddhahood. Since sentient beings are immeasurable, from the point that this commitment is made, those who remain resolved, whether they are asleep or awake, or even careless, will still constantly gather merit that, like sentient beings, is immeasurable. And since this merit is immeasurable, it is said that attaining immeasurable Buddhahood is not hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the whole section is about encouraging us to achieve the immeasurable. For me, the key is in Geshe Chekchok's book, the Gyeltsa Jay's commentary, where he starts with a syllogism. The reason we can do this is because the subject, the person and the aggregates, do not exist inherently because they are dependent arisings. And so, and then verse 211 too, it gives the analogy. If a vast effect arises from a small cause, then one should cease to believe that a measurable effect comes from the immeasurable causes. So when Venerable was teaching it, she said, if we use that analogy, we can create a small cause and experience a huge result. So collections of merit and wisdom are each immeasurable, and the results are immeasurable. If the causes were measurable, the result would still be immeasurable. But the causes aren't even measurable. So the results are also. So our ordinary minds can't grok this, she said, but the Buddha can. And it's like there's no merit counter in the sky somewhere. What's actually needed merit-wise will vary according to the power of the object, according to the intensity of our practice at various times throughout our lives. But, encouraging us that it's doable. So I wanted to refer to a teaching that Venerable Chödrön gave on Manjushri practice that I've been working on for a long time, which she lays out the fact that we can create merit and become Buddhas based on the four truths of the Aryas. And it's such a beautiful explanation or exposition of what happens. I wanted to go through that, okay? So it starts like where we are right now. First, there's dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, suffering, and misery, which we have. Yes? Second, we see there's a cause of dukkha. Our own ignorance, our anger, our attachment, and these causes are not external to us. They are consciousnesses, and they are defilements in the mind. So then, understanding that they are defilements in the mind, we have to understand a little bit about what mind is. So mind is defined as clear and knowing. Familiar, right? Clear has two meanings. The mind is formless, and the mind is able to reflect objects. So inside this category, there are different kinds of mind, so it's not just a solid lump. We know that there are different kinds of consciousnesses, like our sense consciousnesses, our mental consciousnesses. We have gross, subtle, and extremely subtle levels of mind. We have all these mental factors. Our anger is there. Our compassion is there. We have all of these things. But from the Sanskrit tradition point of view, the basic nature of mind is clear and pure. And that includes our primary minds, our sense consciousnesses and mental consciousness, and the extremely subtle clear light mind that goes from life to life. Clear and pure. So within that clear and pure mind, some of our consciousnesses are deluded. Our anger, our attachment, our ignorance, our jealousy, our pride, all of those, they are deluded because they misperceive the objects, but they are defilements that can be removed from the pure nature of the mind. Now, why is that? Because these are minds of defilements that arise from grasping an inherent existent. The mind itself, this is an important sentence, The mind itself is not inherently existent. And if the ignorance that grasps at inherent existence is not an inherent part of the mind, then ignorance can be removed. If now this is a thesis, if the mind itself is not inherently existent, which we have to prove to ourselves, and if the ignorance that grasps at inherent existence is not an inherent part of the mind, which we have to prove to ourselves, then ignorance can be removed. Thus, all of these afflictions can be removed also. Right? So, that pure nature of mind, that is our Buddha nature, which also has two aspects. So one is called the natural Buddha nature, which is the emptiness of the inherent existence of the mind. And it is a permanent phenomenon, right? Then together with that, we have the evolutionary Buddha nature, which refers to the clear and knowingness of that conventionally existent mind. That's our evolutionary Buddha nature. So, another important sentence. Having these two types of Buddha nature shows that the mind on a conventional level is not inherently tainted, and that the mind on an ultimate level is not inherently existent. Therefore, ignorance, anger, attachment, so forth, can be removed again. So when we remove these afflictions from the mind, we arrive at the third noble truth, true cessation. The path that gets us to that fourth truth known by the Aryas is the fourth truth. That's the path. And basically, all the different kinds of wisdom consciousnesses that realize emptiness help us remove all the defilements. So, important point, since everyone has the two types of Buddha nature, it is possible for everyone to become a Buddha. It's just logically laid out so clear. The minds of enlightened beings and the minds of ordinary beings are equally empty of inherent existence, and conventionally they are both clear and knowing. The difference is that we ordinary sentient beings still have clouds in the sky of our mind, you know, obscuring that clarity. And these clouds are the ignorance, anger, and attachment. A Buddha does not have these, not at all. And these are the causes for what these next questions are coming to, is the four Buddha bodies, right? So this idea about having our Buddha nature is totally revolutionary. That everyone has the potential to become fully enlightened is, like, who else teaches this? No other spiritual tradition has this idea. No other system of philosophy really has this idea. So the Buddha was really quite, revolutionary. And that's why the Dharma is swimming upstream. that this disparity between ordinary and divine beings is something that we can bridge. It is not an insurmountable chasm. It is simply a question of whether the mental defilements have been removed. So when we do that, we get the Buddha. So then we have to think about what is the Buddha, and that's what these next questions get us to. I did some research, too, on Alex Berzin's website about this factor, and he, of course, he has different language for it, but he talks about these two kinds of Buddha nature, but he also mentions a third kind that I haven't heard so much, but I thought it was really worth mentioning. So he has what he calls the evolving traits, which is the same thing as our evolutionary Buddha nature, the naturally abiding traits, which is the emptiness of the mind itself. And then he cites a third factor, the factor of a mental continuum that it can be uplifted or inspired by a Buddha's enlightening influence. So we can be inspired, not just by the Buddha, but by the influence of our teachers, of our gurus, and that the two collections or the two networks of wisdom and compassion then has the capacity to grow. That's a factor contributing to our capacity. So he says, our minds are different from a rock. The Buddha's influence is not going to stimulate the rock to become enlightened. But it can stimulate our mental continuums to become enlightened. No matter how rock-like I sometimes feel like my mental continuum is. It has the capacity to be stimulated to be developing these qualities. And so the reason this is important, I think, from his point of view, is this talks about the importance of dedicating or directing our merit. When we're kind of aware of how this is working in our mind, our merit and our wisdom, he says we have these kind of orientations. We can direct it towards samsara building. We can direct our merit towards liberation building. Or we can direct our merit towards enlightenment building. Right? So the merit we get from our karmic actions done with our confusion builds up a happier samsara. La, 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 la. Which, generally speaking, if we're not very mindful, that's probably all we want. It isn't really all we want. But on a day-to-day, numbed out, automatic, just let me have a little peace and happiness. But what a waste of our merit. If we dedicate it for liberation, that's what we get. If we dedicate it to enlightenment, that's where it goes. If you don't dedicate it at all, it will just contribute to your continuing samsara. A happier samsara? Okay. But it doesn't get us out of cyclic existence. And he has an analogy. That's really one of the reasons I wanted to go to this little detour here. I thought it was great. He said, the simple analogy I use is, if you do something positive, like on a computer when you make a document, then in which folder do you save that document? Do you save it in the samsara folder? Or do you save it in the liberation folder? Or do you put it in the enlightenment folder? And the default setting is, if you don't choose, it's going in the samsara folder. So it's very important to be aware of when we're creating virtue and to dedicate it where we want it. Otherwise, we may have chocolate cake tomorrow, or some life will have it, and that'll be why. But it's not because we were just on automatic. And chocolate cake, two bites and it's over. Right, we're in samsara. So very helpful to understand the mechanism of that. I also wanted to get a little detour into the reminding us of what makes an action heavy, as long as we're into merit, and what gooses our merit, what enhances it, what expands it, what makes it grow. So these are the five things to remember. One of the things that strengthens our merit, and this is also what strengthens our negativity, so it's these are the factors that make karma heavy, whether it's virtuous karma or non-virtuous karma, but usually we talk about it in terms of non-virtue. But we can also be very intentional about it in terms of virtue. So the first one is the strength of our intention. So that's part of why we get into the habit of setting our bodhicitta motivation before we do anything, even if it is what Berzin calls labored. Labored and unlabored, as opposed to, I think we use contrived and spontaneous. So you have to reason it to bring about the feeling, but that's okay. And the strength of our intention then that comes from that kind of motivation when we're doing virtuous actions makes it heavier. We get more weight. The way we do the action, the method, is the second way of it. So if we do it repeatedly as a habit, that merit gets stronger. You know, we wake up every morning and make our three prostrations, go to bed at night, make our three prostrations before we go to bed. those small little things accumulated over a lifetime of waking up and doing three prostrations first thing in the morning, that's quite an imprint in the mind. Now, it also, the next one is under that, the method is how, it's like how you do it. How much energy do you put in it? When we're putting offerings on the altar in the morning, do we stop? Do we visualize? Are we really turning it into nectar? Are we doing it on behalf of all sentient beings? Are we visualizing the entire merit field? Are we just kind of like, oh, mangoes, nice, dung. Sometimes we probably do one, and sometimes we probably do the other, especially if we're running short of time. But we can strengthen the merit of that action. If we do it ourselves with all of our energy versus doing with a group, actually doing it ourselves with all of our energy has more merit. Then if we take delight, if we rejoice in it, we're happy that we just made that offering, that makes it heavier. And if we plan for it, prepare for it, work it, that also makes it heavier. So if we write Venerable Children a note at the end of our retreat and we dash it off in pencil on a piece of sticky paper, I've done that. Not so meritorious. We take the energy to really write, you know, something more thoughtful and offer it in a way that's really quite appealing or pleasing or that she can read. Type them. That helps. Then afterwards, if we rejoice and really relish it, that also makes it heavier. So to be really happy when we talk about rejoicing in what we just did. So the third one in the reverse, if we're talking about negativities, is the lack of an antidote. So in this case, it would be like if we dedicate, or if we, before that action gets blocked by an arising moment of anger or something like that. And so the fourth one is, of course, if we're holding wrong views while we do the action, that kind of mitigates them or tones down the merit. If we reflect that the agent, object, and action are interdependent and empty, that makes our mind and the action itself more pure. And then the object of the action is also something that makes it heavier or lighter. So, I mean, if you are doing actions in relationship to the three jewels, with all that merit, I mean, looking at that, it makes sense that we also get tremendous much more merit when we're doing actions in relation to the three jewels. So if we're offering those donuts to the Buddha, as opposed to just bringing them to the breakfast table, we get a whole lot more merit. If we are offering them to the Buddha knowing that soon they will be on the breakfast table, we have not offered them. It's just been a little stopping resting point on the way. So we have to really watch our minds. But when we are genuinely offering in relationship or doing any kind of virtuous action in relationship to the Buddhist, then the merit is really quite strong. Okay, thoughts or questions on that? Yes.
I want to say that when reading verse 2:11, right, when I think about the immeasurable effect of a Buddha, then the need for the immeasurable cause makes sense as well. Like, you know, if you want to really effortlessly, limitlessly benefit all beings, that's how much merit you need. Then I feel inspired to practice. Or even just thinking about our current situation, like, why do I have food to eat? A big part of it comes from Venerable's merit. That's what I think of it.
Yeah.
And obviously all the way back to the Buddha.
Yeah.
So if we want to benefit others, like the merit we make becomes their meal, perhaps, in some future life.
That's nice. Somebody else had a hand.
You said that if we do something by ourselves, it's more meritorious than with a group. It seems like that would vary on what the mind is doing, whether we're just doing it because everybody else is, or whether we're encouraging others to produce merit.
As opposed to like leading them rather than just following along. Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those being the extremes, but we could just be encouraging one another.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, that makes sense too. It's really what's in our mind. I mean, that's, you know, you break out these five things, but to be deliberate, really be deliberate about what we're doing. Okay. What is a Buddha? What is an Arya Buddha? What characteristics are both neither in one but not the other? I was a little bit disappointed that I had this question because I didn't get it when I mean, I got the book, the textbook, but the more I thought about it, the clearer it got. So it would be nice to see what people came up with. Go for it.
Okay, this is the first start. Buddha is an ultimate quality that has arisen from its cause, the fulfillment of the two collections.
And an Arya Buddha
is a person. The enjoyment body and the emanation body.
Who is fully awakened.
Shakyamuni Buddha, for example, was an emanation body.
For example.
There's a person.
Yeah, yeah. So I was trying to figure out, like, Buddha, does that mean it's like a category? The Buddha that's not a person, is that just like a category of qualities? I know, it's not the Buddha. It's just Buddha. What does that mean? I mean, the more I thought about it, the more I think it really is the collection of qualities. Like later I have it in here, the kaya, the Sanskrit word for that we translate as Buddha body, the kaya, literally means a collection of qualities. So if I think about it in terms of a collection of qualities, every one of the and it really I think causes, this is me kind of trying to figure out what this really means. But I think if we look at all of the factors that come together to create even one aspect of this, I mean, well, that's the next question, right? Is a poor Buddha? Yes. Is a mark Buddha? Yes. Is a sign Buddha? Yes. The curl? Yes. Anushnisha? Yes. The Dharma conscious Buddha? Yes, all of which are a collection of merit and wisdom, a collection of qualities, a collection. So if I think about Buddha as the collection, it makes more sense to me. Yeah.
I found this in the Mountain Doctrine. Mm. Buddha, an essence of immeasurable, incomprehensible, unfathomable, excellent, exalted body, wisdom, qualities, and activities extremely wondrous and fantastic, is vast like space and the holy source giving rise to all that is wished by sentient beings, like a wish-granting jewel, wish-granting tree, and so forth.
Mm.
That's that with collection. I don't see person. I see this exquisite collection.
Because it's easy, I think. I mean, I think the reason for me that it's a little bit of a stumbling block is to, you know, how much you want to personify the Buddha, which makes the Buddha a lot like God. And Buddha's not God. So this thing of really thinking about the collection of qualities, each aspect of which can be identified as Buddha, but is not a person. It's just something to really meditate on. So Venerable had a couple of nice things, well, a lot. So if Buddha is the ultimate quality that has arisen from its cause, the fulfillment of the two collections, it means it's not arising from nowhere. And it's not coming from a discordant cause. It again points us back to that it's coming from the two collections, the collection of merit, the collection of wisdom. And then she goes on to talk about, you know, it's the Buddha is the four bodies, the the hands, the arms, 32 signs, the mental qualities, the 21 unpolluted wisdoms, a list of which I found. So that's Buddha. It kind of expands our mind, my mind anyway. I find it's not so sticky and wanting to make it a thing. Even a consciousness. I can get off person and make it a consciousness, which is not 100% wrong, but it's not 100% right either. On the other hand, an Arya Buddha is a person, as you said. We talk about Aryas, they're all people. So again, she emphasized again, the body doesn't mean the physical body. The body of the Buddha is a collection of qualities. So this corpus of qualities, as opposed to an Arya Buddha who is a person. So is that clear for everybody? That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah.
I did stumble a little bit on the fact that the enjoyment and the emanation body were a person. Because after I start thinking about all these qualities and the enjoyment and emanation bodies are so much collections of these qualities, I couldn't hang person on those as much as I could, let's say, Shakyamuni Buddha as a person. So I was surprised to see that they were a person rather than just an a quality of emanation that comes from this mind that has these qualities and this capacity to emanate these bodies. But I don't see. I got stuck on it.
But Shakyamuni Buddha is an emanation body. He's a supreme emanation body.
Right, but this is where I got stuck.
That's where,
I couldn't
get those things together.
Put them together.
Right. But I wonder if we think about a person being an abstract composite. It's an abstract composite that's imputed on its basis of designation. So if we think about those qualities being the basis of designation, then we impute person. We impute person on the emanation body. We impute person on the form body. On the Sambhogakaya too. So part of the question is, the four questions. What is both Buddha and Arya Buddha? What's an example of that? Shakyamuni Buddha. What's another one? What is both Buddha and Arya Buddha? Another example. Green Tara, Amitabha. Yeah, Medicine Buddha. Okay. So what's an example of something that is Buddha but is not an Arya Buddha?
The nature truth body.
Another one? Oh, nature truth body, sorry.
Yes.
Another one?
Buddha's marks.
Another one? The Usnisha.
The curl.
Feet, Buddha, but not, yes, okay, they're not persons. Also, the Buddha's ultimate bodhicitta. Somebody asked that. That was your question. What's an example of something that is Arya Buddha but is not Buddha? Nothing. There's no such thing. Can't be. Why?
Arya Buddha falls into the category of Buddha.
Yeah.
And that the Buddha or the qualities are the causes for an Arya Buddha. The Buddha, the qualities, the collection of all of this are the causes or parts of an Arya Buddha. They're not inseparable. You can't have an Arya Buddha without the 32 marks and signs, without the infinite wisdom, without the nature truth body, without these aspects of Buddha.
Yes, I think that's true, but it's not a causal relationship. It's a dependent relationship, but it's not a causal relationship. Because they arise they all arise simultaneously. Yeah. So What's something that is neither Buddha nor Arya Buddha?
Me too.
The cats. The turkeys. We don't know that, actually. We don't know that. We don't know that. Okay, are we good with that question? Yes.
In the sutras, it talks about after Shakyamuni Buddha arose from under the Bodhi tree and was enlightened, he was walking along the river and somebody saw him and asked him, "Are you a god?" He said, "No." Are you a human?" He said, "No." He said, "What are you?" And I believe he said, "I am Buddha." Meaning, and it's translated as, "I am awakened."
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he says, "I am a Buddha" or "the Buddha." I think he just says, "I am Buddha," but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. And, you know, the Pali tradition actually would not have this view of what is Buddha. They wouldn't hold that, although it would make sense, even if you look at it from the Sanskrit tradition, that answer, "I am Buddha," would be right on the mark.
But they translate that word as meaning, "I am awakened."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Question, point, comment?
Oh, I just love how thinking about this topic explodes our idea of some inherently existent Buddha. And it makes me wonder about the created emanation bodies. Like, you know, when Buddha can manifest as a bridge, or like, how much is it dependent on our mind recognizing that? Or the effect of that bridge on our mind? Is that how it comes about?
Yeah.
And I was thinking of that because, if I recall correctly, there was once Jeffrey Hopkins was talking about how he was sitting in a bar and he looked down at the end of the bar and there was this deadbeat guy with the totally drunken. And he looked at him and I thought, I cannot wind up like that. And then he thought, maybe that was the Buddha.
Yeah.
In terms of the effect on his spiritual practice.
Yeah.
So I was just curious what you thought.
We'll never, I mean, as long as we're ordinary beings, we'll never know. But it is a really interesting thought. Later on, I pulled out from Meditation on Emptiness three main types of emanation bodies. Artisans, such as guitarists. Really? Goldsmiths or scribes. Constructions, such as trees or a deer. Or a bridge, you know, the blanket thing, or supreme beings who display the 12 activities of a bodhisattva and become a Buddha. So those are types of emanation bodies. They're categorized types. But how much of that is from our side? How much is from the Buddha's side? Well, isn't it a 50-50 thing? Right? That's what Venerable always says. It's part our karma. It's part the enlightening influence of the Buddhas. The Buddhas are working constantly to try to help us. Our merit is what hooks them in. Our merit is what makes us able to be influenced. So, yeah. And even the story of Maitreya and Asanga, right? All those years he meditated to see Maitreya and couldn't see him, even though he was there all along. And then I love it that when he finally had the vision or saw Maitreya and put him on his shoulders and carried him through town, only one old woman could see him, and she saw an old dog on his shoulders. That's merit. So, yeah, that would be my guess. Wouldn't it? Life would be very different if we thought like that. But we can. How did we get these teachings? How did we get these teachings? Phew. Unbelievable. Okay, question 7. Do hearers practice the collection of merit and the collection of wisdom? Answer? No. No. Why?
Collections of merit and wisdom are only possessed by bodhisattvas. Hearers and solitary realizers don't have these because to be a collection of merit, it has to be supported by the wisdom realizing emptiness. To be the collection of wisdom, it has to be supported by bodhicitta.
Yeah. Yeah, they're missing the bodhicitta. They have the wisdom, but they don't have the wisdom supported by bodhicitta. And they don't have bodhicitta in general, so their wisdom is not supporting that bodhicitta. Oh, I lied. I didn't do question 5 through 7. I did question 5 through 9. Okay, we're good for a while, though. How do Hera's creation of merit differ from Bodhisattva's creation of merit?
So now we get back into sharp and dull, modest. Some hearers and solitary realizers have sharp faculties, and some have modest faculties. They cultivate the same wisdom as bodhisattvas. However, because they aspire for hearer or solitary realizer awakening and don't generate bodhicitta, they enter their own vehicles when they have a stable determination to be free from samsara and a firm determination to attain arhatship.
So that's how their merit differs. Yeah. I have a simple answer. No bodhicitta, less merit. Much less immeasurable. But that's true. So bodhicitta is really the key. And they do generate merit. They generate a lot of merit. But it's a different motivation. Okay, so then what factors are necessary for our creation of merit to become the collection of merit?
Being influenced by bodhicitta, isn't that when we enter the bodhicitta ground, the bodhisattva grounds, and that's when you start to create a collection of merit and wisdom?
Yeah. And how do we do that?
Through practicing the six paramitas.
And
meditating on emptiness.
Yeah. So we become... Our creation of merit and our creation of wisdom become the collections of merit and wisdom based on our practice of merit and wisdom now, based on our bodhicitta motivation, all the meditations that we do to cultivate compassion and bodhicitta, all of our study trying to understand wisdom. All of these are the causes that eventually ripen or lead us to the deeper understandings or the realizations that do become the collections of merit and wisdom when we enter the paths. So we'll cultivate uncontrived bodhicitta, enter the path, progress through the stages of realizing emptiness. But you don't get there if you're not doing practice as an ordinary being, trying to understand and develop these good qualities. Okay, and then we have a little time to spend on the Buddha bodies. Question 9. Unless there's anything else on the factors necessary. No. Okay. So the question is, what are the 2 Buddha bodies? What are the 3 Buddha bodies? What are the 4 Buddha bodies? What are the 5 Buddha bodies? Which ones are permanent and which ones are impermanent? This is the chart I wanted to draw, but I ran out of time. This is from Geshe Kelsang Wangmo. Charts. Buddha bodies. Charts of Buddha bodies. So again, what I said earlier, the original meaning of the Sanskrit word, actually that which is accumulated. I said it wrong. Kaya. That which is accumulated. So, collection is valid. Body is confusing. Corpus. However, this is really important. The kayas of the Buddhas do not literally refer to any of the form aggregates of the Buddha. They refer to the various attributes and so forth of the Buddha. Do not literally refer only to the form aggregates. Sorry. And the first, the kind, one kind. I mean, you can also say that there is one Buddha body, the Dharmakaya. Kaya and Dharmakaya are synonymous. Whatever is a kaya is necessarily a Dharmakaya. And vice versa. Everything comes from the Dharmakaya, right? The truth body. And this is from Hopkins. Truth body, Dharmakaya, one Buddha body. Two Buddha bodies. Form and truth body. So the Dharmakaya and the Rupakaya. Three Buddha bodies. Dharmakaya, truth body, Sambhogakaya, enjoyment body, Rupakaya, Rupakaya is divided. Sambhogakaya is the enjoyment body. The Nirmanakaya is the emanation body. That's what Rupakaya means. So Dharmakaya, Rupakaya, two branches. Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya. Four. Wisdom truth body. Nature truth body. That all comes under Dharmakaya. Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya. Enjoyment body and emanation body comes under Rupakaya. See, a chart would have been a good idea. Five. This is interesting. I found two different places, two different things, but it's not that. From in Meditation on Emptiness, I mean, and both of these sources cited Ornament of Clear Realization as the source. So I don't know if this may be one of those debatable points, but according to the way it was laid out by Hopkins, the five is nature truth body. He doesn't call it truth. He just calls it nature body. Wisdom truth body. The actual enjoyment body and the imputed enjoyment body. The emanation body. So Venerable Dongcho was telling me that in the Chinese tradition, they do identify two different enjoyment bodies, two different Sambhogakayas. So the actual enjoyment body is the at least from here, is the Sambhogakaya that arises as that teaches the bodhisattvas. The imputed enjoyment body is such as the body of a 10th ground bodhisattva. That's all it says. However, I found three different sources that followed Venerable Children's version that said the nature truth body, so the emptiness of the Buddhist mind, can be divided into two. The emptiness of the inherent existence of the Buddha's mind and the true cessations of the Buddha's mind. And that's what I found in several different sources. So that's something to look up to find out what those are. So we get what the five are? Okay. So it would be the nature truth body, which would then be divided. So the nature truth body, which is the emptiness of the Buddha's mind, right? So it would be the natural emptiness of the Buddha's mind, the emptiness of inherent existence of the Buddha's mind, and the true cessations of the Buddha's mind, meaning those things which have been eliminated or exhausted, the exhaustion of the defilements. Then the wisdom truth body, which is conventional nature of mind. Then the Sambhogakaya, the enjoyment body. The Nirmanakaya, the emanation body. So is that clear what these things are? I want to talk a little bit more from Venerable Manjushri teaching about what these are. I think it's very clear. She says even if we divide the Buddha in terms of two collections, three, four, five, they all come down to the same point. It is just a different way of categorizing. So as we recall, Dharmakaya means truth body, Rupakaya means form body. Dharmakaya refers to the aspects of the Buddha's mind. And the Rupakaya refers to the different manifestations of forms that the Buddha appears in. And, you know, we can't tune into the Buddha's omniscient mind. It's too subtle. We don't have that frequency. She said it's blocked by interference from the TV and our iPhone. We are form-based being. We relate to sights, sounds, tastes, and touches, and so it's out of compassion that the Buddha manifests in these different physical forms. And Geshe Kelsang Wangmo talks, she has a different translation. She wants to call them own benefit kaya and other benefit kaya. Is it the Chinese call, Duke? But I'm not in Zenbuka right this minute, but I'll come back to it. Because this, for this division, the way it's divided is other benefit kaya is the, other benefit vaya is the rupakaya. Own benefit kaya is the dharmakaya. Why? Own benefit kaya is what the Buddha enjoys. We don't really get to directly enjoy the Buddha's omniscient mind. It's quite indirect. It is, but it's also of great benefit to the being that achieved it. The other benefit kaya, does it help the Buddha that the Buddha appears in Sabokan Pakaya, an emanation body? I mean, at that point, probably not, but it helps us a lot. Otherwise, how would we get the teachings? How would we get the fruit of that omniscient mind? And so it divides it. It's an interesting way of doing it. The great compassion is the cause for the other benefit kaya. Wisdom realizing selflessness is the main cause for the own benefit kaya. And then this makes the West method in wisdom, the two wings of the bird, which are not, you know, causal. They don't have a causal relationship. That's also really important. Own benefit kaya is the cessations and realizations. Cessations of afflictions and the cognitive obscurations. Other benefit kaya is all the different emanations of the Buddha. And they come, when you attain Buddhahood, they come simultaneously. It's not like one comes first. Okay, so the form body, the rupakaya, dividing into two types, the sambhogakaya kaya and the nirmanaka kaya. Sambhogakaya kaya means resource body or resource collection. And it's a body of light that manifests in a pure land to teach the Arya Bodhisattvas. So it's a resource for very high level beings. This Nirmanakaya is the emanation body is a coarser form. But it comes spontaneously and continuously from the Sambhogakaya, of which there is one in this system. Any emanation that appears on earth to communicate with and lead sentient beings could be a nirmanakaya. So what's the division in the Chinese?
It's according to the mind-only school because it's coming from Buddha Bhumishastra and the Mahayana Sangraha. Yeah. Which are all mind-only texts. So you have the Svabha Sambhogakaya, which is for your, it's the body for your own benefit. It says, it derives from the countless virtues that originate from the accumulation of immeasurable merit and wisdom over a Buddha's infinitely long career. This body is a perfect, pure, eternal, and omnipresent material body that enjoys the bliss of Dharma for oneself until the end of time. And by contrast, the Para Sambhogakaya is a subtle, virtuous body deriving from the wisdom of equality, which resides in a pure land and displays supernatural powers in order to enhance the enjoyment of the Dharma by bodhisattvas at all 10 stages of the bodhisattva's career.
And then is there another thing that's an emanation body? No. Well, that first thing that you read it sounds like an emanation body. Doesn't it? A form body that appears.
Yeah, but that's separate. No, then there's still the Nirmanakaya. So these are two types of enjoyment bodies is what they have.
Huh. And then what is the Nirmanakaya defined as?
In this school, I don't know.
Well, that bears more research.
Yep. They call it, this might be a translation thing. They just call it a transformation body. Anyhow, more research needed.
So there's also just a little bit more about the mind of the Buddha then. The Dharmakaya, which is the Buddha's mind. The wisdom truth body, the nature truth body, we talked about that. The wisdom truth body is the omniscient mind. It is an impermanent phenomena that is eternal, changing moment by moment, but never ending. So even the Buddha's minds and even Arya's mind perceiving emptiness, I've always questioned about this, they're pure minds, yet they change moment to moment. Why? Because they are consciousnesses. Consciousness perceiving an object does not perceive the same thing one moment to the next, even the Buddha. So whether the Buddha is in a physical body as a Nirmanakaya or appearing as a Sambhogakaya Buddha in a pure land, the consciousness does not end. Why? Its basic nature is clear and knowing. So when we, like, you know how we've been corrected, like when a great lama passes away, that Nirmanakaya consciousness doesn't end, right? It's not like they die. It's not like they die in the same way. And, you know, we can get some sense of this ourselves if we do that meditation that's at the beginning of guided meditations on the stages of the path, where we're guided to look at the moments of mind and go back and back and back and look at our previous moments of mind. You know, today's mind was based on yesterday's mind. Yesterday's mind was based on the days before's mind. The day before mind is based on the day before mind. You start going back and you can go back. You know, today's mind is a product of 10 years ago mind. And you go back 5 years before that, 10 years before that. You do birthdays or major events, something to take yourself back to childhood, back to when you can't remember anymore, but you know you had a mind. You know, back into the womb, because you know you had a mind. Why? Because the more we do that, we see that one moment of mind is followed by another moment of mind. There's no stopping of that. So we go back, and we get to the moment of birth. We see there had to be a moment of consciousness before that from somewhere. We go back to the moment of conception. We see there had to be a moment of consciousness the moment before that from somewhere. So that really helps us get this sense of the continuity of consciousness, and then we go the other direction. Doesn't stop. The body dies. What happens to the consciousness? One moment of mind follows another. Where is it going? Hopefully not into a turkey. Yeah. But it wakes us up a little bit to do that meditation and to get a sense of that continuity. There's no beginning. In terms of the flow of the clear knowing consciousness, there is no beginning and there is no end. However, and this is very important, there is an end to the samsaric mind. There is an end to the contaminated four mental aggregates, feeling, discrimination, conditioned, or miscellaneous factors in the primary consciousnesses. But just because the samsara ends, our mind influenced functioning under the influence of karma and afflictions. The karma and afflictions can end. The mind does not. Thus, you have the wisdom body, Buddha's mind, going on through infinite time, and that is the wisdom truth body. The wisdom truth collection. The wisdom truth corpus. The nature truth body, the svabhavikaya, is a permanent phenomena, unconditioned, which means it doesn't change moment to moment. So I want to end a little bit with Venerable's teaching of that day on what is the mind of faith and how we use this kind of reflection to help support our merit. So the Buddha's qualities are inconceivable. And she cited a story in the Pali Sutras where the Buddha picked up a handful of leaves and he said, what he's teaching us, compared to the omniscient mind of the Buddha, what he's teaching us is about this much. But it's enough to get us to his place. So the Buddha's qualities, just like the Buddha's qualities or the Dharma qualities. Why? Because the Buddha practiced to become a Buddha. He practiced the Dharma to become a Buddha. And once he did, he teaches the Dharma. So that too must be as inconceivable as the Buddha's qualities. And the Buddha is a member of the Sangha jewel. So it includes the Arya Buddha. So the Sangha's qualities are also inconceivable. So even if we can't understand this, if we study and reflect on these things, we can cultivate a mind of faith based on some knowledge and reasonable conviction. Then the amount of merit we create from that faith is also inconceivable. By the power of the object itself, inconceivable qualities, we reflect, cultivate faith based on that, then the merit we create from that faith is also inconceivable. This is how we got here in this room. Not blind faith, but faith that comes from knowledge and awareness. And the more we know about the Buddha's qualities, the greater our faith will be, the more merit we generate based on that kind of faith. And then she talked about, you know, that she talked about the quality of faith from people, especially who grew up in old Tibet. They may not have studied, they didn't go into the monasteries, but they grew up in an environment where they heard and understood these things. You know, and they did have an understanding. It's not blind, not a blind faith. But they, she said, when you hear about great compassion, what's not to have faith in? Right? I mean, we're so cynical. We'll doubt. Oh, really? Can you have that kind of compassion? They don't have that kind of question. And so, especially said the people who grew up there, who had, you know, just were like inundated, were immersed in Dharma from the beginning on. She says the old people, now they're just about dying out, but they're not sitting in front of the television, you know, like old people here who don't know what to do with their minds, don't know what to do with their lives. They're chanting manis, they're doing their prayer wheels, they're working to benefit sentient beings because they have conviction in the practices, they have conviction in the practice of creating merit. They are creating merit. And they're creating right up until the moment that they stop breathing, and hopefully afterwards, they're creating the causes to continue to be able to practice the Dharma based on that faith. So the point of this whole thing is when we have faith, especially based on understanding or reasoning, then the amount of merit we have based on the three jewels is immeasurable because the three jewels themselves, their qualities are immeasurable. And the deeper or greater that faith of conviction, the greater the merit. Similarly, when we make prostrations, when we make offerings and rejoice in the merit of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the field with which we create the karma is so rich and the good qualities are so immeasurable that the merit we create by something as small as one conscious prostration or rejoicing for just a minute or two, she says, is enormous. So, our teacher says, we should think about this and realize that any small action we do in relationship to a field of merit that is so potent is definitely worthwhile. So indeed, I've said it from the beginning, this monastery is built on the merit of Dzogchen. She will not like to hear that. But, you know, we can contribute, and we are contributing, every one of us. Everybody who's out there practicing, too, we can contribute to that. But we can do it more intentionally. I could do it more intentionally. Thus, verses 212 and 213.
212, in brief, King, the Buddha's form body arises from the collection of merit, and their truth body is born from the collection of wisdom. Thus, these two collections cause the attainment of Buddhahood. Hence, in short, always devote yourself to merit and wisdom.
So I think we can take that as personal advice. Thus, in short, always generate merit and wisdom. Thoughts, questions, comments? Yes.
This is related back to question 9. You know, how we divide the Buddha bodies also relates to the philosophical view, and it shapes your whole understanding of what the path
yeah.
and the grounds are. Right?
That's true.
Which I found kind of amazing. I mean, just I'm slowly working through Jitsun Choki Gyaltsen's presentation of tenets. So, you know, when you go back to Vaibhashikas, that they don't accept that a Buddha's form aggregate is Buddha. It's an object to be abandoned. Right? And that it says that they don't accept a complete enjoyment body either.
No. Yeah. They don't have any of that.
Right, because the continuum is severed at the awareness is severed at nirvana. So I mean, just trying to wrap my head around that, like, wow, how you assert the types of Buddha bodies you assert is related to your philosophical view.
Yeah. And this is definitely Prasangika presentation. Yeah.
And too, when I was working with Venerable Tianchang, I remember we were talking about Buddha bodies, and then she said, "Oh, the Buddha has 3 bodies." I said, "No, it has 4." Like, it was so like, duh. And I was like, "Oh, yeah, I guess it must be taught in a whole different way."
Could be 3, could be 4, could be 5, could be 2, could be 1. Yes. No, 4 bodies. Yeah. Yeah, it definitely does depend on the view. And, you know, as we may dismiss, oh, the Vaibhashikas, but how pure is my view? I'm sure I'm not even a Vaibhashika sometimes. But the more we think about it, the more we study, the clearer it gets, the more faith grows based on reasoning. So let's do that together.